If the Senate confirms former Deputy Defense Secretary Ashton Carter to replace Secretary Hagel, his agenda will include a military conflict in the Middle East, tensions with Russia, and loud cries for defense acquisition reform, among other subjects. John Shouse is a fellow in the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He and his colleagues are proposing a specific agenda for Secretary Carter if he is confirmed. Thank you very much for joining me this afternoon, John. What is the most important thing that you and your colleagues detailed for Secretary Carter if he comes back? Or was that not the approach that you took to put them in a particular order? Thank you for joining me today, John.
Thank you, Francis. It's good to be on your show. I think it's right to say that we didn't take a particular order approach. I think the Secretary is going to have, or now, if he's confirmed, Ash Carter as Secretary, will have a really complicated agenda facing him. And of the many issues we lay out, I think the one that will cut across all is sequestration and finding a way either to repeal it or to really reform the Defense Department to be able to operate within it.
One of the things that I have watched with interest as we've observed Secretary Carter, Dr. Carter, the potential comeback to the Department of Defense is the confidence that people have all across the spectrum in Congress, in think tanks, within the building, and so on. A great confidence in his ability to navigate the back room stuff to be able to get some kind of consensus build as far as what happens with the budget. Is it your sense that that will be something very important for him to do, or is it really out of the hands of the SecDef at this point, and is it really just depending on what John McCain and Mac Thornberry can get together on, and maybe the appropriators as well?
I think that is an excellent question, Francis. I think certainly, the House and the Senate under John McCain and Mac Thornberry's leadership will have a significant role. But I think their positive statements about Secretary Carter leave the door open for him to show some leadership. And you know, his previous positions within the department give him a lot more knowledge and tools to use in trying to come up with solutions that will work for folks on the Hill, compared to the last two secretaries who've come as relative newcomers to the Defense Department.
You write in particular under a part of this called Managing Rising Powers in Asia, and you write the next secretary will take office 3 years into the administration's policy to rebalance to the Asia-Pacific. And you mentioned that Secretary Kerry is very heavily involved in activities in the Middle East, trying to negotiate, broker some kind of peace agreement there. And so it will fall to the next Secretary of Defense to be a very high-profile leader in this rebalancing effort, while at the same time working with our partners in other parts of the world to assure them, I imagine, that we haven't forgotten about them. How does that balance work in your view, and how much emphasis do you expect to see Dr. Carter or whoever the next secretary is pay to Asia in comparison to Secretary Hagel, Secretary Panetta, and Secretary Gates?
I think the track record of all three previous secretaries of defense in the Obama administration has been very good on Asia. Secretary Gates was focused. He went to the Shangri-La dialogue every year, made a point to do that, and his successors have continued that trend. And Secretary Hagel has been particularly engaged in the Asia-Pacific over the last time that he's been in office. I think from Ash Carter's time as deputy, he is certainly interested in the Asia-Pacific, and he previously made a point to put energy into that. I expect that will probably both continue and increase when he's in the secretary position, because he'll have more latitude and more opportunities to get to Asia. I think that the real challenge will be finding ways for him to contextualize and, as you put it, reassure the other allies in other parts of the world that the U.S. has both the bandwidth and the capabilities it needs to be present across the world.
And that bandwidth issue is probably where the delicacy comes in, because at the same time other countries watch us fight amongst ourselves about what to do about the defense budget, they're pretty much, especially our European allies, they're pretty much all shrinking theirs. They're not able to do the same kinds of operational supplements to wherever we happen to go that they've been able to do in the past. Is that fair to say, do you think?
I think that's pretty fair. I do believe that the Russian invasion of Ukraine and Crimea earlier this spring is causing several countries in Europe to reconsider their defense budgets, to consider bolstering their budgets. And at the very least, I think what we're seeing is a strong track record of greater cooperation amongst the NATO allies to ensure that there's the kind of interoperability and the practice, if you will, to do the things they'll need to do should Russia be, you know, continue to be obstreperous.
John Schaus is a fellow in the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He and his colleagues writing a recommended agenda for the next Secretary of Defense. I think this is the most interesting sentence that you wrote in this piece. The entire body of work is excellent, but this one jumped right out at me, John. Sustaining a focus on the Asia-Pacific will be difficult when crises in other regions constantly pull attention away, especially when Asia largely works. And you have the word works in quotes. I assume that you're implying as long as affairs there continue on a trajectory that's not immediately threatening to the United States, it will be easy for other things to distract us. Did I interpret that correctly?
I think that's pretty close. I think what we've seen over the last maybe 40 years really is an effort largely driven from within Asia, but also supported by the United States and other powers, to develop a security architecture within Asia that allows all countries to operate freely, to operate as peers, but fundamentally to operate securely so that there aren't the kinds of security risks, the military risks that we do see in other parts of the world. And as long as that continues, that's good for Asia, but bad for keeping focus on Asia.
You write that one of the items that the new Secretary of Defense should consider is that we should continue to engage China on areas of cooperation, even as the U.S. and China continue to disagree about near fundamental elements of what constitutes appropriate or safe behavior. The core of the issue seems to me to be a trust issue. Is it reasonable, do you think, that we can trust them on some things when we can't trust them on other things, John?
I think I would not use the word trust necessarily. Certainly that's an element of it, Francis, but I think there's another piece to it, which is fundamentally different worldviews of appropriate behavior. In terms of air and maritime security, the United States has a view that aircraft and ships can go up to 12 miles off the coast of another country and operate freely. That's ensconced in the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea. China interprets it differently, saying that military vessels have to stay 200 miles away. And when those two interpretations intersect with each other, we have incidents like we saw in 2001 where the U.S. EP-3 aircraft collided with or was hit by a Chinese fighter, causing an unfortunate death of a Chinese pilot and a crash landing of a U.S. plane on Chinese soil, and a great deal of tension. We see similar events from time to time, and developing a way to get through those policy differences, those legal interpretation differences that don't lead to crisis. I think that's one of the big issues we need to find our way through.
Final thought, back to sequestration. Is it the vehicle of sequestration, in your view, that will be troublesome for the next Secretary of Defense to deal with, or is it whatever the budget number is that is a result of that that's problematic? Is it the vehicle or the number?
I think it's
or both.
Hard to separate the two. Right. I think the vehicle makes long-term planning difficult because the department won't know from year to year what to expect necessarily. Is it up? Is it down? And the absolute number also becomes complicated because it forces very difficult trade-offs, especially in a world where the department is being asked by the president and the Congress to do more in places like Iraq and Syria. And that's a tough challenge.